House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Friday, April 3rd, 2009. There's an overflow room, 343, if you don't have a place to sit, and they have it there. Today we have a full agenda. We're going to take a little bit out of order. We're going to go to House Bill 3399, since there are so many people here to speak today. Because we have so much to do and there are so many people, we are going to ask you to limit your time at the microphone to 3 minutes. We have a timer. The assistant here will be watching that. And I want everybody to have to say what they need to say, but please don't repeat what everybody else has already said, because we really are getting jammed for time. It's getting already, for this committee, late in the session. So I would like to call first Mr. Bombardier, Lana Colley, and John Elron, please.
And House Bill 3399 creates the crime of vehicular homicide. It directs a police officer responding to certain accidents to conduct an automatic DUI investigation. It provides that the results of a breath or blood test would be admissible at trial for vehicular homicide, makes refusal to give a breath, blood, or urine test admissible at any court proceeding, and we do not yet have the fiscal. I believe there are amendments on the way.
Thank you. And please identify yourself before you speak, because it is recorded for the record. Just say.
My name is Jim Bombardier. I live in Multnomah County. I'm a victim of an attempted vehicular homicide. In late January of 2006, I was riding on Highway 30, 2 to 4 feet off of the paved portion of the road on the shoulder. I was hit from behind by a Chevy Avalanche. I took off the side mirror with the back of my head. I'm alive. They told me I should be dead, but I'm alive. I'm here to tell you that the current laws don't represent a proper balance of the rights of everybody out there. And it's in favor of the car culture. I grew up in the car culture. My dad fixed cars. He taught body and fender. But the balance isn't right anymore. It needs to change. The guy that hit me is deceased. He probably shouldn't have been driving. He got a careless driving citation that the state patrolman didn't show up at the court case, so it got passed on. I was at the deposition before this guy died. He had no remorse for having hit me. It's not right. Do something about it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate that. Ms. Colley?
Good afternoon. My name is Lana Colley. I'm the DMV Program Services Manager. You have my written testimony, but there was just a couple things, concerns that we have with the bill that I wanted to bring up to you today. The first one is Section 17, which amends the statutes relating to the rights and consequences for implied consent laws. The drafted changes would require only those individuals that get a 30-day temporary driving permit to have their full rights and consequences provided. So those individuals who weren't issued a temporary driving permit would not be informed properly of the time frame to request the hearing or the time frame for the hearing to be withheld. We don't believe that that was anything intended with this bill, so we would recommend that that section be removed. And the other issue concern that we have is Section 11 and 13 of the bill, where it's changing the commercial driver license statutes. Currently today under the law, when your base driving privilege, which is your regular Class C driver's license, is suspended or revoked, it results in a suspension of your commercial driving privileges. And then in addition, the statutes 80944 and 80914 already provide for disqualification and suspension of your commercial driving privileges for conviction of a felony, and this bill is making vehicular homicide a felony, so it would already result in the disqualification or suspension. So our recommendation is that you would remove Section 17 and Section 11 and 13 of the bill. We do not believe it would impact the original intent of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Elrod?
My name is John Elrod. I live in Clackamas County. I'm the ride operations leader for Portland Velo, the cycling club that Tim belonged to. More often than not, Tim and I ended up riding together due to our skills or interests, whatever. There wasn't a week that went by that somebody hadn't reported an incident where a car would buzz them. A lot of times the big monster trucks would come up, and especially the diesels would romp on their throttle and try to shower us with clouds of smoke. And riding in a group, well, we could deal with it, I guess, and I can't believe that there's so many people out there that ride alone because of the intimidation that cars present. They are weapons and can be used as such, and we are very much in favor of the consequences for improper behavior on the road are not near as great as the damage that they cause to the friends and family of all those riders that are out there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Reed, would you please come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I recognize you have a very busy committee, so I won't be here long. In fact, yesterday in our own committee, I was limiting people to 2 minutes, so I don't think I'll take any longer than that. I know what it's like to have the gavel and try to get through a long agenda. I just wanted to add my voice to those who are here supporting the bill. I recognize that this bill is not only not scheduled to be worked today, but is not yet in a form where it's ready to be worked. But I know that there are a number of people who have been involved in the drafting and continue to work on a variety of amendments to get closer to its intent and to a workable situation. So I commend your continued attention to it. And I think it really speaks to the goal of trying to create a transportation system where everybody has a safe way to participate. Everyone has a chance to deal with the consequences that may result in a manner that's reflective of the choices and behaviors that people choose to undertake. A lot of people who I think have yet to testify. I apologize for getting here a little late, so I'm not sure who went before me, but I think you'll hear very evocative and poignant stories about why this bill matters, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Representative? Thank you very much, Representative Reed.
Thank you.
Scott Bricker, Mary O'Donnell, and Ray Thomas, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and thank you for the opportunity for hearing the bill today and having us have an opportunity to speak. For the last number of legislative sessions, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance has been working to increase the safety of Oregon's roadways for non-motorized users. Last session, we, with all of your help, passed a law called the Vulnerable Roadway User Law, a really important piece of legislation. Today we're back, and we're back because there are people that are currently driving vehicles that have no business driving vehicles, that have had suspended licenses or habitual offenders of the law, and those people are killing roadway users, our loved ones. Today I have a panel with me. Today I have Mary O'Donnell, who's a widow whose husband was killed, and this bill is requested by Mary in honor of her husband, Tim, and a BTA Legislative Committee member, as well as Ray Thomas, who is also a BTA Legislative Committee member and our legal expert on this issue, who will spend more time actually explaining the details of the bill. Again, I just want to kick this off by saying, 2007, 455 people were killed in Oregon's roadways, including 50 pedestrians, Tim, and 14 other bicyclists. Again, Tim was killed by a driver who had multiple suspensions and really had no business on the roadway, and this bill would deal with specifically those types of drivers. And we're here today to make the case for the importance of this bill, recognizing that there's a little more work to do on this bill, but really hope that this committee will consider moving it forward when it's ready. Thanks.
Thank you. Mary, the timer will not be on for you, so please take your time and you just say what you need to say. Thank you very much.
Chairman Barker, thank you very much, and members of the committee. My name is Mary O'Donnell, and I live in Aloha, Oregon. On June 9, 2007, I lost my husband to a driver who should not have been on the road. My three children lost their dad, grandchildren lost their grandpa, and they all missed him very dearly. When Tim left the house, he had a big smile on his face because he was going out to ride with his Portland Velo riding group. He did this every Saturday morning. His love of bicycling was very special to him. Towards the end of the ride, he was on a Cornelius Shefflin Road in Cornelius with his fellow riders in rural Washington County. They were all making a left-hand turn, and the driver came out of nowhere and just wiped him off the road and killed him instantly. What happened next, I cannot go into detail about, so I ask you to read the letter that we have given you so you'll understand what happened. My request to you is that today, April 3rd, which is, I didn't plan it this way, would have been our 51st wedding anniversary.
Thank you.
I'm spending it alone on all those to come without Tim because a dangerous driver ran him down on his bike. I know that Tim would be alive today if this driver who hit him would have quit driving when she got a ticket for driving uninsured in Oregon. My main reason for wanting this bill is that I have to make something positive come out of this. Tim would have wanted me to do this in his name because he was a responsible rider and wouldn't have wanted this to happen to any of his fellow bicyclists. There are many supporters in the gallery that are supporting this, and I would like them to stand if I could. Could I have them all stand, the supporters? And they're wonderful people, and they've been very good to me. And please support this bill, this Oregon vehicular homicide law, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ray Thomas, and I'm a member of the Bicycle Transportation Legislative Committee. This bill fills an important gap in Oregon's law enforcement mechanism. Oregon is one of four states without a vehicular homicide law. We do have a criminal homicide law, which is called criminally negligent homicide. We also have in Oregon a vulnerable user law. The problem is that the vulnerable user law is a traffic infraction related to careless driving, and criminally negligent homicide requires proof of a gross deviation from the standard of care, which by the time you get that to a jury really requires reckless behavior on the part of a driver. The problem for prosecutors is that when they see somebody who is driving without a license, choosing to drive without insurance, driving while impaired, including distracted, what they have is a situation where if that person kills somebody because of negligent driving, it's very difficult to obtain a conviction for anything more than careless driving. If there's reckless driving, then criminally negligent homicide does a pretty good job of picking it up. But many of these folks who get behind the wheel where they know they don't have a license, where they know they shouldn't be driving, where they've decided to go without insurance or any financial responsibility, those folks will make a mistake and cause a death, and there's really not much a prosecutor can do to provide any type of consequence where these folks are going to be in the system and supervised. And it's toward that end that the vehicular homicide is being provided to you. And the reason that it provides an enhanced responsibility is because when somebody gets behind the wheel of a car, they take on a great deal of lethal potential. And it only costs $300-$400 to get a car that is capable of killing somebody with a simple mistake. And in our materials, we provided to you, for example, a case you may remember from 2007, Sean Hagen, who ran down 77-year-old George Bertoglio in a crosswalk in downtown Salem. After Mr. Hagen hadn't had a driver's license for 7 years, he'd accumulated 16 suspension tickets, and yet he was still driving around, driving down the street as you tried to cross the street outside the Capitol. There, unfortunately, exists a gap in our system in Oregon to do something about these folks who continue to drive and kill. And we're asking that while This bill is something that does plow some new ground for us in Oregon. And we understand, and there is pending, with legislative counsel, an amendment which we believe will address a number of the concerns that folks have raised with the procedural operation of this bill. We believe that this amendment, when it's provided to the committee, will in fact provide an important addition to our criminal law enforcement. And we request that you take a look at it, and rather than try to push this bill to a vote today, to schedule a work meeting for this so that you can have an opportunity to take a look at those important changes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony. Gail Meyer, Martha Springhill, I think, and Rankin Johnson. Please go ahead in any order you wish, and just identify yourself for the record when you speak.
I'll go first, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do weigh in respectfully to in opposition to House Bill 3399. What we note about the bill is that it would criminalize someone for a result, a negative result here, a death, when the defendant, him or herself, was not at fault for causing the death. There's no requirement in this bill that the driver actually cause the accident. And we think that is the major problem here. There's no requirement of mens rea on behalf of the driver, so there's no requirement for reckless conduct, negligence, intentional behavior. And, in fact, the victim may have been the cause and the fault of the accident. So I live in a section of town in Northeast Portland where there's a lot of bicyclists, and some of them are standing upright on their cycles, no hands on the bars, talking on cell phones, their own selves, and they'll blow right through a four-way stop. So as this bill is written, there is no requirement that the defendant who's driving the vehicle actually be at fault in the causation of the accident. What's being passed out to you is an analysis that we've undertaken of the vehicular homicide laws in other states, and they're sort of in two separate packets. One of them is just a comparison of vehicular homicide statutes on western states, Oregon, Washington, California, and Idaho. And you will note in the bolded text there that the other states do require at least some mens rea or fault requirement on behalf of the driver as a predicate towards finding a conviction for vehicular homicide. And then we also thought we'd take a comparison of the vehicular homicide statutes in the five most bicycle-friendly states, and we got that off of a website listing for bikelead.org. And those states were Washington, Wisconsin, Arizona, Oregon, and Minnesota. And again, you will notice in those other bicycle-friendly states, they also require a mens rea requirement or an element of fault on behalf of the driver. Present with me are two lawyers from Portland. Rankin Johnson is on my left. He was at the Office of Public Defender Services for 5 years. He's done a lot of appellate litigation of vehicular manslaughter cases. And on my right is Martha Spinhern. She's a trial lawyer, a major felony trial lawyer with the Metropolitan Public Defenders in Portland, and she's tried several vehicular manslaughter cases. They're here simply to talk about the laws that currently exist and how this would be a deviation from those laws.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Rankin Johnson. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. I bike to work for 3 or 4 days a week, and I absolutely agree that bicyclists need to be protected from motorists who aren't paying attention to them. I agree that bicyclists need to have the same legal rights on the road as motorists. I think that's very important, and I'm well aware of how poorly motorists notice and react to and respect cyclists' rights. However, this bill is not going to address a lot of the problems that people have already spoken about, and it works a substantial change in the way that Oregon criminal law works. Currently, criminal law focuses on fault. It focuses on what kind of bad behavior caused a criminal result. As Ms. Meyer explained, the laws relating to vehicular homicide in neighboring states and in bicycle-friendly states all require some degree of fault. They require criminal negligence or recklessness. And currently, that's the way that Oregon law works. Somebody has to be negligent or reckless in order to be culpable for this kind of an accident. And the way the bill works, that's simply not required. Somebody could be punished for a homicide, for an accident caused by the victim. That is a substantial change, and in my view, it is an unwarranted one, and for that reason, I oppose the bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Cameron.
Thank you for your testimony, and I share some of your same concerns, but if I'm driving a car without a license, am I not negligent against the law right there? I'm negligent of the law without insurance or a driver's license?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, no, that's not negligent. It is certainly an offense, and depending on the circumstances, it might be a crime or it might merely be an infraction. But not having a license does not affect the quality of the bad driving. In my view, if somebody is going to be punished for the consequences of bad driving, it requires bad driving, and bad driving means negligent. It means a violation of the rules. There's a substantial body of rules regarding what constitutes acceptable driving. Not having a license is not that kind of mistake.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. So, ignoring bad driving, stopping, just, I get in my car, I don't have insurance, I don't have a driver's license, I'm now breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and representatives. My name is Martha Spinhern. I've been a public defender for the last 22 years. I have litigated several vehicular homicide cases. I've also litigated many, many felony driving while suspended when we had such a crime in Oregon. Prior to going to law school, I was a claims adjuster for many years. So I have sort of the unique experience of having both a civil and criminal background. I am opposed to this law because I do not feel that it adequately addresses the problem. I should also add, I gave up my car. I gave away my car last May. I don't own a car. I don't plan on owning a car again. I commute by bike, take public transportation, walk along the side of the road. And I also have a former husband who was hit by a car while riding his bicycle and very seriously injured. So I sort of run the gambit. This law does not address the problem because, for example, in the first witness that spoke today, he talked about being hit from behind, which was exactly what happened to my former husband. That person would not be found negligent, would not be found guilty of a homicide if they had insurance and had a driver's license, even if their driving is what caused the accident. As a claims adjuster, I had to explain to an insured once why I had to pay a claim when the other person was arrested for driving under the influence after the accident. And that was because under the civil law, the cause of the accident, the proximate cause of the accident, which is a civil standard, was my insured's running a stop sign and T-boning the other person. Investigated the claim, eyewitnesses, there was absolutely nothing wrong with the driving of the other person, even though once the police came to investigate the accident, they discovered he was under the influence. In Oregon, we have, and then also in my review of the friendly, the statutes that we've provided under the five friendly bicycle states, those all require at a minimum criminal negligence homicide, which is a ignoring a substantial risk that is a gross deviation, and that is true. We have that law in place, which covers vehicular cases as well. The law as it is now, as the statute that's in front of me, as has been said, it requires no mens rea. It's just a matter of whether you have a license or you have insurance or not, and someone dies when they come in contact with your car. This won't solve the problem of keeping people off the road. I see perhaps a fix to the problem listening to people today, because it's a problem you hear about, and people talk about repeatedly about people driving on the road without a license after having been suspended for a number of reasons, some of them because of their driving. Maybe we need another felony driving while suspended. When I was defending those, people went to prison because they were driving on the road without a license, even if they weren't driving negligently. And so maybe taking away a felony driving while suspended was a mistake. And I don't have the statistics on what happened after we did away with that law.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Olson, do you have a question?
No, I'm going to pass.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Scouten, you're on a different page, so I missed you the first time. Please come up.
Chairman Barker. Good afternoon, Chairman Barker and members of the committee. My name is Dick Scouten, and I'm on the Washington County Board of Commissioners. And I'm a motorist, bicyclist, a county commissioner, and currently a member of the Oregon State Bar. Let me just state briefly that the questions about mens rea will be and are discussed in the amendments stuff. So the testimony that you heard is, in a way, sort of a straw man issue at this point, because there will be changes in those issues, as I understand them, will be addressed. And I will leave it at that and leave the criminal lawyers and the draft people here to sort that out. But I think those will be addressed. I just wanted to speak more on the policy issues and just want to note that there were over 41,000 people killed in automobile accidents in the U.S. in 2007. And our numbers are substantially higher than they are any place else in the first world. If we had some disease or some kind of a situation where that many people were killed every year, we would be utterly outraged. And we should be outraged. We need to bring those numbers down, and there's going to be any number of ways that we can do this. I think this is one piece of doing that, and I think that's important. Every life is important. We need to do something to bring down these incredible numbers. You've heard the numbers for Oregon. I'm giving you the numbers for the U.S. These are real people. We need to do something, and there are any number of ways, and this is one piece to do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. Thank you all for coming down today. We really appreciate your support in this issue and your interest in your civic duty of coming here. Close the hearing on House Bill
3399.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 3271.
That'd be me.
The penalty for harassment under certain circumstances when a person subjects the victim to alarm by conveying a threat to inflict serious physical injury against the victim or victim's family, or to commit a felony against the person or property of the victim or victim's family. We have a -1 amendment that's in front of the members, and we do not yet have the fiscal or revenue statements on the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stigler, please.
That'd be me. Thank you, and be kind. For the record, my name is Judy Stigler. I am the state representative from District 54, Bend, Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my rationale for having this bill drafted arose out of a realization that under our current scheme of criminal laws, we haven't necessarily kept up with technology. And after many long conversations and a lot of research, I came to the conclusion that within the constraints of our constitutional provisions for free speech, we had limitations on what we actually can do in this area of cyber stalking, whatever you want to call it, electronic harassment. So this bill is really designed to do a couple of things. It's to enhance repetitive conduct by people who send emails, who send text messages, who send, you know, harassing kinds of electronic transmissions to people with the intent to harass, with the intent to alarm, with the intent to cause a lot of consternation. And what it specifically does is to first it modifies the definition of it actually defines what electronic threat is. And the dash one amendments that you have before you today, I'd ask that we not move them. I'm working on some dash twos. I've met with counsel from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association trying to address a couple of their concerns, and I'll tell you briefly where I'm going to ask that the dash twos head. And the dash twos, in speaking with legislative counsel, they'd much rather wrap them all into one amendment and move one amendment rather than have two separate amendments. So what we've done here is to enhance the penalty for certain of these kinds of behaviors when certain situations occur. First of all, that the harassment is committed under circumstances that the person committing them has been previously convicted of electronic kind of harassment, situations where there's a reasonable belief that the person to whom the communication is being transferred is under the age of 18 at the time that the offense was committed, where there's been a stalking or restraining order previously entered, and let's see here, and or a situation where a person conveys a threat to kill or to either the person to whom the recipient or a member of the family of the other person. It's with respect to provisions under online, I believe it is. I knew she did that.
I like your new rule, Mr. Chair.
You like the new rule? The amendments that I've agreed to have drafted specifically go to, let's see, down on, I think it's line 29, the big A down there at the bottom, line 30, pardon me, that the enhanced penalty will apply to the person conveyed a threat to kill the other person or any member of the family of the other person, and the amendment will read, and the person has a previous conviction for this offense under subsection 1C above, and the victim of the current offense was the victim or member of the family of the victim of the previous offense. So trying to bring some consistency there. The other change will be on page 2, if you go down to line 5, the person reasonably believed that the victim was under 18 years of age and the person was less than 3 years older than the victim, and that's consistent with language in other parts of our criminal code. So my intent here is to, again, bring us up to the modern era and how we communicate. We don't always communicate verbally or by written, by a note or a letter slip to somebody. I mean, we've gone long past that. I would also note that the definition will also be consistent with some definitions we've passed already this session in this committee having to do with electronic communications, so there'll be consistent definitions so we're not having different parts of the criminal code having different definitions for essentially the same thing.
Thank you.
That's it.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
Representative Stiegler, thank you. Just in our district here yesterday, we had a situation where some people, through text messaging, found some threats of actually attacking a school with minors in it. Would those people fall underneath this harassment situation? Because the
That probably would, my guess is, well, it depends on what exactly those communications were. If they were, if they went to a specific person, then this would probably qualify. If it was something, I think, if my understanding is of that situation, it was they were gonna exact greater harm than, I mean, they were directed at just more than individual. I don't know all the circumstances. Okay. I would say it might,
thank you,
but some of it is probably going to fall under different parts of the criminal code.
Thank you.
And what's so funny?
Close public hearing on House Bill 3271. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3194. And also House Bill 3295.
House Bill 3194 includes a prior juvenile adjudication for driving under the influence as a predicate for felony DUI enhancement. 3295 requires that diversion programs for persons under 18 must include a prohibition on the use of intoxicants during the programs, and we do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on 3194.
Or 3295?
We can, 3295 is ready.
Jim Bernard, Allison Butterfield, and John Wentworth, please.
He could have.
You can go ahead and identify yourself and begin, please.
I'm County Commissioner Jim Bernard from Clackamas County.
There always should be remorse.
I'm John Wentworth. I'm with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office.
For the record, we're here to support 3194 and 3295. And first off, I'd like to thank Representative Barton for introducing these measures on behalf of the county. I provide the committee with a written testimony, so in the interest of time, I'll shorten my comments. I, however, would like to touch on a few points regarding the new bill. Then I'll turn to Allison Butterfield and a juvenile counselor in Clackamas County, and John Wentworth, Deputy District Attorney for Clackamas County. John handles juvenile matters in the county. They'll speak in greater detail about these bills. Clackamas County handles juvenile DUI matters in juvenile court. We also offer a diversion program through the juvenile department. We do this under collaboration between the county, circuit court, and the district attorney's office. This model is unique in that in our in other counties, these matters are handled through circuit court. This model has proven to be very successful. The recidivism rate is as low as 5%. Because of this success, other counties have expressed interest in handling these matters in a similar fashion. Allison can talk more about the philosophy of this arrangement and to its success. Since the county implemented this model in 1995, we have identified several issues that compromise its continuation and its integrity. The first is the fact that state DUII third offense statute specifically references convictions on juveniles in juvenile court received dispositions. This issue is addressed in HB 3194. The second is regarding a non-existence of a provision in state juvenile code statutes allowing for diversion agreements with youth as a condition of eligibility. This issue is taken up in HB 3295. John will speak in greater detail about this matter. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Allison Butterfield.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee.
I am here to represent Clackamas County Juvenile Department, and I am the Juvenile Department's lone probation officer that deals with DUI offenses. The primary reason that the Clackamas County Juvenile Department took jurisdiction of DUIs, there are two primary reasons. The first one is that developmentally, adolescents are not in the same developmental stage as adults, and when they enter the diversion program, they are referred to adult treatment programs. The other reason is that when juveniles are referred to an adult diversion program, there is almost no oversight. The only things that they are required to do are to complete treatments, to do the DUI impact panel, and to pay the diversion filing fees. There is no case management at that point. And the juvenile department, by taking jurisdiction, allows us to provide more intensive supervisions, more sanctions. We are allowed to use detention. We provide drug tests for the youth for the entire year that they're in the diversion program. We can use detention as a sanction. We can put them in residential treatment placements. And worst case scenario, we can place them in correctional facilities. I have, I believe, provided the members of the committee with our DUI data. We did begin this program in 2005, in July of 2005. And since that time, I have received a total of 80 referrals. 45 cases have been closed successfully since 2005. Currently, I'm still supervising 27. 4 cases were not successful, and they did result in correctional facility commitment. 9 youth had their diversion revoked. 4 youth received their second DUI while under court supervision. And since that time, only since their case closures, only 2 youth have reoffended and gotten second DUIs, which puts our recidivism rate at 4%. And my understanding is that the general recidivism rate is anywhere between 30 and 40%. We are still tracking this on an annual basis. I am a LED certified counselor, and so I check criminal history checks and DMV records of all of the youth that we've had through our program on a yearly basis to find out if they've received any new crimes. The glitches that I am encountering, that we're all encountering at the juvenile department, is that the juvenile department diversion paperwork does not say that the youth can't use substances. And on a number of occasions, I've had youth who are in the diversion program who, as soon as they were done to treatment, went right on using substances. I had one young man who had 9 dirty UAs after he finished his treatment program, and I was not able to revoke his diversion. His counselor successfully argued that it is not a part of the diversion paperwork. Therefore, he was allowed to continue and be successful in the diversion program. He passed, even though he had 9 dirty UAs. I've had that on a number of occasions, and it really limits my ability to intervene with them if that's not a condition of their diversion. The second issue that I'm dealing with is I have had 4 kids, as I said, who have received their second DUI while under juvenile department jurisdiction, and both of those, or all 4 of those, were between the ages of 16 and 17. We still handled the case, but those were considered adjudication and disposition, and so because they're not considered convictions, if any of them get a third DUI, those previous 2 do not count against them as convictions. So those are the primary reasons that I support these 2 House bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay, I'm sorry, 1 more speaker. I said.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you and good afternoon. Once again, I'm John Wentworth. I supervise the juvenile prosecutors in Clackamas County. I'm here in support of these 2 bills, mainly because we're impressed by the success that the juvenile department has had in handling juvenile offenders, DUII offenders, in their treatment programs. And there's going to be some movement. We've seen encouragement or some interest from other counties in modeling their programs, their juvenile programs, after what we have in Clackamas County because of our success and the numbers that you see before you. As Ms. Butterfield was saying, however, in the process, we've noticed loopholes or some issues that have come up. One that was of concern to the DA's office was what is addressed in House Bill 3194, which deals with convictions of persons who commit DUIs. The problem, as you may be aware, is that the language that's used in the juvenile realm is different from that which is used in the adult realm. And so we have this difficulty of youths who can become adults, but even though they may have already had 2 or 3 DUIs as juveniles, since those aren't necessarily convictions in Clackamas County, the youth could end up getting 2 or 3 bites of the DUI apple before there's any problem with them in the adult realm. It would be treated as a misdemeanor instead of a felony. So that was seen as a problem that we need to address and what is addressed in 3194. Likewise, with House Bill 3295, we came up with an issue in court where a defense attorney was arguing that her her youth was not eligible to be revoked from the DUI diversion program, even though he had consumed intoxicants during the course of that program. That came to us as a surprise to us when we looked at the statute, that and it does not actually prohibit that kind of behavior, even though youths cannot consume alcohol in the first place. So these are, in some regards, that's kind of a housekeeping measure in terms of cleaning something up that that really shouldn't be a problem and seems to be fairly straightforward.
Thank you, Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I neglected to, I declined to testify, but allow me to say the Clackamas County is behaving here, I think, exactly the way we want local governments to do so. They are innovating, and it's working. They are getting better results at less cost, and they need our help. And I would love it if this committee was able to provide that help.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Stegler?
Yeah, and I just want to applaud you guys. I've been aware of your program from fairly early on, and I think sometimes we realize we don't always understand that impediments to innovation, to key off of Representative Martin, sometimes exist, is there in the existing law, and I applaud you for trying to, you know, be innovative in spite of all of that. So, you know, hopefully we can help make this more. And the bottom line is, I know what you want out of the juvenile programs is you want you know, to stop the behavior, but you also want the accountability aspect of it. So sort of don't want to hamstring your ability to do either of those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3194 and open a work session on House Bill 3295.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move House Bill 3295 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 3295 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Representative Barton, would you carry that for us?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2349.
House Bill 2349 permits in its original form, permitted a landowner who was in dispute with a contractor to file a surety bond with an escrow agent instead of the county recorder. The Dashlin Amendment deleted this provision and instead clarifies the owner's entitlement to interest earned on surety bond and creates a process for the county to follow when releasing the lien. You now have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, and those will actually take the place of the Dash 1s, and I believe the proponents can speak to those. But we do not yet have the fiscal, sorry, Mr. Chair, on the Dash 2s.
Okay, thank you. Lori Steele and Hannes and Alex Kyler, please. That'd be fine. Gather around.
Okay.
Right there.
Yeah.
We could move
the amendments, but not. No. The dash. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Members of the committee, Chair Barker, good afternoon. I'm Shelby Rahala, Government Affairs for Washington County. The original concept of House Bill 2349 was to shift the function of recording and managing construction liens to escrow companies to hold the lien. After discussions with the escrow companies, it became clear to us that this was not feasible. So the Dash 1 amendments were our response, figuring that if we had to keep this function, let's make it as workable as we can for the counties. The rest of the panel will speak to the problems that the current statute causes. So this was our amendment in an attempt to clarify some of those issues. The Dash 2 amendments simply correct a statutory citation error on the Draft 1, so they are essentially the same thing. The four main provisions of this bill that are reflected in the Dash 2 amendments that clarify some of our issues are, first, clarifying the depositor's entitlement to interest earned on the deposited funds. Second, ensuring counties will not be improperly brought into the suit to foreclose these construction liens. Third, describing the contents of the court's order to disperse the funds. And fourth, establishing a process for the county treasurer to follow when releasing a lien or in the event that a court's order is unclear. So I would like to turn this over to the rest of my panel who has significant experience with the questions and problems raised by the current statutes and in dealing with the administration of these construction liens.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Dan Olson, Washington County Council. We brought this bill forward because the statutes are pretty old and they're very confusing, and what tends to happen is the attorneys who, when we see the cases anyway, the attorneys involved really aren't sure what to do, and so sometimes they end up naming the county in what is really a private lawsuit to foreclose the lien. We don't have any interest in the lawsuit at all, but we're holding the money. And then there are questions about how the money should be dispersed and where the interest goes and so on. In 2008, Washington County was named in three lawsuits involving these statutes. I'm not going to go into the details, but there were ambiguities in the court orders, questions about to whom the interest should be paid. Neither party wanted to go back in front of the judge and get it cleared up. We didn't have the right to go back to the judge and get it cleared up. In one case, we attempted to use our best judgment and disperse the funds. The next thing we know, we were named in a garnishment proceeding. Next thing we know, we got a tort claim from the other side. And then eventually I had to prepare an interpleader action before we could get everybody in a room and get it resolved. That case alone took 14 and a half hours of my staff's time, cost our finance department $1,600 of attorney time, and that doesn't include the finances department or involvement or risks involvement. We had another one that took us about 18 hours to resolve, and that cost about $2,000 in attorney's fees for our treasurer, again for claims that we had no interest in. We were just holding the money waiting for somebody to tell us what to do with it. So we're proposing this to provide clear guidance as to exactly what we can do, and one of the most important provisions is that we cannot be named in the lawsuit, the underlying lawsuit. We'll just do what the judge tells us to do, and if we don't know for sure what the judge is telling us, we inform both parties. They have 14 days to tell us what to do, or we can go ahead and proceed with our best judgment and not have them come after us.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Steele. I'm the treasurer for Marion County, and I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of real-life situations that have happened in Marion County as a result of construction liens being filed there. Many years ago, prior to my joining the treasurer's office at Marion County, we had an attorney come in with paperwork indicating how a lien, the money deposited, should be distributed. So the treasurer acted on that paperwork. Later, that was found to be inaccurate. The county was sued and lost. So we were on the hook for that money that was distributed from that construction lien. As a result of that case, Marion County instituted a policy that any time someone comes in and requests disbursement of the funds that were deposited, I have to take that to our legal counsel for review, and then they tell me how to proceed. And as a result of that, they bill me for every single case that they review, so that has caused an increase to my budget, which is out of Marion County's general fund. We also have a case ongoing right now, a gentleman who deposited money with my office more than 3 years ago, and just several months ago, my staff noticed that that was still deposited in our office. We contacted the gentleman. He said a suit had never proceeded, and he would like his money back. So I forwarded that request to my legal counsel, who has been unable to determine whether or not a lien was or a lawsuit actually commenced due to the high volume of other cases this gentleman is involved in. So we are spending an enormous amount of legal time trying to figure out what to do with this money, and we'll probably end up spending more than the actual dollars that were deposited at Marion County as a result. So we're hoping that the changes that are in this bill will provide a much clearer opportunity for the county to disperse the funds without entering into any legal issues with the person who deposited the money. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Alex and Ann.
Annis, please.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, I am Alex Kyler. I'm the Lane County Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and my written testimony really does mirror the testimony that you've just heard. We have had a similar case where not our treasurer but our financial services manager was named in a lawsuit, and that resulted just from the attorneys who were filing the suit going onto the website, and instead of finding the treasurer, they find the name of the financial services manager, named her in the suit, and county council has since been working to unentangle that situation, much like the other counties have described. Our case also involved, once the court order was made, it was less than clear, and the attorneys argued over how that money should actually be distributed, and thus our county council entered the fray for round two on the actual distribution. So the point being that this bill will provide some guidance around what has just really been sort of a legal entanglement, as I described. So we'd urge you to pass the dash two amendment. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hannis. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. Association of Oregon Counties supports this bill because it'll make the process clearer, it'll be less costly, and disputes can be settled faster while minimizing the need for lawsuits. I've distributed my testimony around for you, so with that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the brevity there on that written testimony. Is there any questions from the panel at all? Thank you. We can adopt the dash two.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Krieger. Sorry, Representative Wisnan. Looked right by you there.
I move the dash twos into House Bill 2349.
Representative Wisnan moves the dash twos in House Bill 2349. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Before I do that, open the work session and do those. So ordered. Close the work session. Ramona, sorry. Okay.
Feeling stuff is standing here.
Yeah, that's right.
Call me Krieger. I was trying to get over that.
Life is tough.
Elevate one person with one word is difficult, but would happen, wouldn't it?
Now we can move that. We don't have a fiscal yet.
Open a public hearing on House, or I'm sorry, open a work session on House Bill 2972.
House Bill 2972 was first heard on March 27th. This is the bill that shifted the burden of proof to the offender to prove that he or she met the requirements for relief from reporting for a sex offender. This has a minimal expenditure impact. It has no revenue impact, and it's ready to be worked.
Any questions from the committee?
Representative Wisnan. Chair, I move House Bill 2972 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2972 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any questions? Roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
I guess so.
Representative Olson.
All right.
Representative Shields.
Are you on that?
Aye.
Yeah, you're on that.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Steger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
2972.
Representative Barton, will you carry that bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Open a work session on 2968.
House Bill 2968 was heard on the 27th as well. This is the bill that allows the Department of Transportation to reschedule an implied consent hearing if the person's attorney is ill or has a scheduling conflict. We adopted the dash one amendments, and it has no minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
It has none. No minimal fiscal. I'm like, wait a minute. What's
it has a minimal impact. New statement issued.
Okay. That's like a double negative. I thought we were back to a positive there.
Any further questions about this one? Call the roll, please.
Oh, we didn't move it.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2968 put amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Westnant moves House Bill 2968 to the floor with a due pass.
As amended.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger? Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank you for hearing all my bills today. If this needs a carrier, I'd be happy to do so. However, this is pretty technical. It strikes me as fodder for consent calendar.
Representative Barton will carry the bill.
Just trying.
You won't be able to wander far from your desk that day. Open a work session on House Bill 2428.
House Bill 2428. Just a moment. Was first heard on February 23rd. It elevates assault in the third degree to a Class B felony if the offense was committed with a motor vehicle while the defendant was driving under the influence. You have a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment amends the bill such that it's only elevated to a Class B felony if serious physical injury is caused. The Dash 1 has not been adopted, and you also have a detailed indeterminate fiscal statement for the Dash 1 amendment. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It will be approximately a $63,000 cost in the next biennium, $363,000 the following biennium, and peaking at $426,000 in 2013 to 15.
Mr. Chair, I recommend House Bill 2429 as amended be referred to the...
We need to adopt the Dash 1s.
I move the Dash 1s into 2428.
Representative Westnant moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2428. Is there any discussion? Representative Smith?
Only one of procedure. If we move those Dash 1 amendments and it has a small fiscal, do we have to get the fiscal redone given the amendments?
This already has. I'm sorry. I wasn't tracking with what you were saying. The fiscal was done to accommodate the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Any objection to the Dash 1 amendments going in? So ordered.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I move House Bill 2428 as amended, refer it to the Ways and Means Committee. What we do pass, we don't just refer it, we just refer it.
Yeah. Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2428 with subsequent referral to Ways and Means as amended. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Goes to Ways and Means. Open a work session on House Bill 2796.
House Bill 2796, first heard on March 19th. This is the bill that prohibited setting aside a conviction for criminally negligent homicide. The Dash 1 amendment makes only one change in that it eliminates the word arrest on the second page so that a person can have... I'm sorry, I'm looking for
the Dash 1, is that what
yes.
It was?
Yes. And the Dash 1s were discussed at the original hearing. We just did not have them. They need to be adopted. We have no. There is no expenditure impact for the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Accept a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2796.
Chair, I'll move 20 Dash 1 amendments to 2796.
Representative Cameron moves the Dash 1s into House Bill 2796. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2796 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2796 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on that? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Resnick?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Probably ought to have that one, okay?
Kevin, you want to do it?
Would you like to carry that? Representative Cameron will be the carrier of that one. Thank you, Representative.
Who's doing the
open a work session on House Bill 2554.
House Bill 2554. House Bill 2554 was first heard on March 16th. This expanded the definition of vulnerable user of a public way. The initial, the Dash 1 Amendment added motorcycle to the list. And I don't believe we adopted
we
the Dash
did.
1. So we, and there's no, their impact statement is no expenditure impact on the Dash 1, so it's ready to be moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wissman.
I move the Dash 1s in the House Bill 2554.
Representative Wissman, that moves the Dash 1s in House Bill 2554. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cameron.
Did we discuss those amendments in the...
We did.
We did.
Representative Olson.
Representative Olson brought it.
Motorcycle got left out. It should be in there.
Yeah, 2 years.
Sorry. Pardon me?
During the 07 session, when this bill was introduced, it originally had motorcycles in it, and then it was removed out of the Transportation Committee. And after watching what's happened in the past 2 years, it's a perfect fit for it.
When the amendment was brought, we didn't have the fiscal on. Hearing no objections, so ordered.
Chair.
Representative Wissnett.
I move House Bill 2554 to the floor without due pass recommendation.
Representative Wissnett moves House Bill 2554 as amended to the floor to due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
So I have Representative Springer carry this bill. Open a work session on House Bill 2857.
House Bill 2857 was first heard on March 19th. This is the bill that, in the form with the Dash 2s, solely addresses felon in possession of a firearm. It would make most felon in possession of a firearm a level 3 on the grid block. It would elevate certain ones to a level 8 if the offender had a previous person conviction. We have statements for the Dash 2s, which do need to be amended. The fiscal statement for the Dash 2 is indeterminate and rather in-depth. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And we do need to put the Dash 2s in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wissnett.
Dash 1s go away, or do we need the Dash 1s and the 2s?
Just the 2s.
Just the 2s. Mr. Chair, I move Dash 2s in the House Bill 2857.
Representative Wissnett moves the Dash 2 amendments in the House Bill 2857. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2857 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
To Ways and Means.
Refer to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Wissnett moves House Bill 2857 with a due pass with a subsequent referral.
Amended.
As amended. To Ways and Means. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Shields? Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Wisnett? If Representative Barton prefers, I will remove my objection to the consent agenda for House Bill 296.
Is there any objection to that going on the consent calendar? 2966 was on the consent calendar.
About this one?
No, it's this.
I mean, sorry.
2968, isn't it? 2968.
2968 sounds better.
Okay, much appreciated.
Is there any further business to come before you?
Don't have to work on it.
Captain Dave.